Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
I come before you and assume the presidency at a moment rich with promise. We live in a peaceful, prosperous time, but we can make it better.
That's former President George H.W. Bush at his inauguration in January of 1989. Tributes and reflections were heard across the country this weekend with the news that Bush died on Saturday. And here in New Hampshire, those memories often had a personal connection. Granite State voters played a key role in Bush's victory in 1988, and several played a role in his White House. Today in The Exchange, Granite Staters reflect on our 41st President, George H.W. Bush. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us in studio, Wayne Lesperance, political science professor at New England College, vice president of academic affairs, head of the college's Center for Civic Engagement. Wayne, you're always helping us out. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Tom Rath, longtime Republican strategist in the state. Back in 1988, Rath worked on behalf of Bush's rival, Bob Dole, in the presidential primary. Tom, I'm sure we'll have some fun talking about that. Thank you so much for being here.
Good to hear you here, Laura. Thank you very much.
And as I mentioned in my intro, several Granite Staters played key roles in the Bush presidency. One of them is with us, Joel Meola, chief of staff for former Republican Governor Judd Gregg, early supporter of George H.W. Bush in his presidential campaign. And from what I understand, Joel, you were one of a group of people dubbed bushwhackers, right, as you drove around
the
state.
We were actually called bushwhackers, but Zeeks.
We were Zeeks.
And there were five of us that were all of about the same vintage right out of college, maybe a little older. Neil Bush, the president's son, headed us up, and we just rolled around the state and put up signs and handed out leaflets and tried to cause as much of a ruckus as we could.
Well, it's great to have you, too. And a little bit later, we're going to hear from Dave Carney, who actually worked in the Bush White House. But what was that like, Joel, to work on that first George Bush presidential campaign? This is 1980, right? The one he lost to Ronald Reagan.
1980. And I was finishing up at Keene State College at the time. And I was just reading a few things and seeing this guy's resume of being ambassador to the UN, the envoy to China, you know, a congressman, just, you know, and his military service. He just seemed like a really interesting person. And I just called up Governor Hugh Gregg from Keene State College and just said, would love to volunteer. How do I do that? And next thing I know, I was in my old pickup truck hoping he would make it from Keene to Nashua. And got to meet with then Governor Gregg, who was heading up the campaign, and he said, "You're on." And of course, anything, it was free, so it was an easy job to get. So I ended up traveling with him, and no one knew who he was. I would hand out literature on main streets, and Governor Gregg and Ambassador Bush would just introduce themselves all over the state. And so we all had different areas of regions of the state that we took charge of and put together a political organization of chairman. And anyways, get to know them. It was, you know, there was no entourage at the time. There were three.
You were the entourage.
We were. And again, no one knew him, but you could just tell the substance and the pedigree that he would be a tremendous president. But more than that, I thought, was the way he interacted with people. And quite frankly, the way he interacted with some college kid was so refreshing and humble. And it was just a terrific experience.
It was a kindness and a decency to sort of the lowest of the low, the college kid who's
right,
a volunteer.
Right. Couldn't have.
You know, speaking of people who work closely with Mr. Bush, I want to bring into our conversation Dave Carney. He's CEO of Norway Hill Associates in Hancock, New Hampshire, a national political consulting firm. And he was former White House political director under the Bush presidency. And Dave Carney, a big welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, my condolences to you and to Joel Meola and Tom Rath. It's a loss for you. You were friends and you cared about this person. You probably heard, Dave, some great stories from Joel Meola about the early days. What was your first experience working with George H.W. Bush?
Well, it's, you know, very similar to Joel's, although he's much older than I was. I was in high school. And I just ended up, you know, being volunteered by Hugh Gregg, you know, to, you know, accompany them as he drove around Peterborough and Jaffrey, and seemed to be every couple of 3 weeks they would be in our area, in the Monadnock region. And I would, you know, sit in the back seat of the station wagon, and Governor Gregg would be driving, Ambassador Bush would be in the front seat, and we'd be going to all these basically homes of people, state reps and former state reps and, you know, community leaders, and trying to, you know, introduce the ambassador to people. And it was, you know, just hearing them talk back and forth about various people and, you know, people I had, you know, met with through the Conville Young Republicans, basically. And we would, you know, chit-chat and, you know, basically go into people's homes, and the ambassador would make his pitch, and he would make a plea to get them on board. And, you know, I'd have some literature, just very similar things. I mean, we had a then I went on to college at NEC, New England College, and still helped out with the campaign. And it was, I do remember one really spectacular event that we had at Pat's Peak. I'm sure Joel remembers this, but Ambassador Bush came, and we had a event there with, you know, quasi-community and college, and it was packed, and it was exciting, and people were, you know, very, you know, very loyal. The people on the Bush campaign, not just the staff like Joel, but the volunteers were completely committed. I mean, they weren't doing this out of some obligation or that he was the front runner or somehow, you know, they were going to get anything out of it. I felt that those people were not just felt they were personal friends of the soon-to-be president, but totally committed to his ideas and his philosophy and his, you know, sort of a I don't know what you call it, the sort of style, you know, his method of, you know, not getting to throw red meat out there, but to actually talk about, you know, ideas and solutions. And I think
That drew people like you and like Joel. And it's interesting, though, gentlemen, that we're talking about former President Bush's campaigns here in New Hampshire and how going through that process here in New Hampshire changed him. I want to play a little bit from an interview with former New Hampshire Governor John H. Sununu. And as we all know, he was White House Chief of Staff for President Bush. And Governor Sununu told WMUR that President Bush was often uncomfortable with the political part of campaigning. He was more about the issues and so forth. Let's hear a little bit from former Governor Sununu on that.
See me, touch me, feel me. And he adapted to it pretty quickly. I remember when he came out of Iowa with that not good result in Iowa in 88, and he had to win in New Hampshire. We worked him awfully hard. We had him going to breakfast at McDonald's and Denny's and Dunkin' Donuts and making him, and I think the right word is making him, because it was political and he wasn't comfortable to begin with, making him interact with people. And pretty soon he got used to the see me, touch me, feel me requirements of politics in New Hampshire. And I think it stood him in good stead as he continued that primary process across the country.
Again, that's former New Hampshire Governor John H. Sununu talking about then-candidate George Bush. Tom Rath, what do you think? The idea that, you know, George Bush was sort of this patrician and very well-qualified ambassador and all these high-level positions. And then he comes to New Hampshire and has to put up with see me, touch me, feel me. So it can be an adjustment.
Well, you got to remember, put this in context, the race that Joel and David were discussing, the first race was in 1980. And
against Ronald Reagan.
Right. And so that was a very different kind of race. And that's the famous I paid for this microphone race. But you look at the people who were on that stage for that debate and the quality of that field field with people like Howard Baker and others involved in it, along with then Ambassador Bush and Governor Reagan. It was a deep. John Anderson was in that race. High quality. There was a different feel to it. When he came back in 88, the race that Joel, the big race we tend to remember, he was vice president of the United States, and he had been vice president for 8 years, and that brings with it a degree of formality. Sure. And distance, and it was hard, just as Governor Sununu alluded to, you have to break through that shell. That was one of the challenges of the folks in that campaign. But I had started, I was... you may not remember because it was ancient history, but there was a brief moment in time when I was Attorney General, and that was during that 80 campaign. And there was a fellow named Lyndon LaRouche out of Rochester who was running, and he threatened to blow the whole thing up all the time. And Reagan proved his sort of electoral strength in that by winning pretty handily. But when by the time we got to and Rudman then that fall got elected to the Senate, and which was really the first hands-on campaign I'd had since Rockefeller, and the mood changed a little bit, and there was an expectation of involvement and engagement, and it was very hard, I think, at first, because the Secret Service had all kinds of rules.
When he was
vice president, certain things you can and cannot do.
Sure.
And I think he had a breakthrough that, and the other thing that I admired about what that campaign was all about was defining George Bush as something other than Ronald Reagan's vice president. The quality and the depth and the you know, stature he had himself. And that's all part of it. And that's one of the beauties of New Hampshire, is that you get kind of peel the onion off a little bit.
Well, and it was hard. I appreciate you saying that, Tom, because it was hard for him to define himself separately
right.
in that later campaign. And George Bush, for all his, you know, positive qualities, did sometimes have a hard time expressing himself. And that, as you all know, caught up with him when he ran against Bill Clinton. Let's hear a little bit of former President Bush. This is him accepting the Republican nomination at the party's convention in August of 1988.
I will keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light. This is my mission, and I will complete it.
Again, that's former President Bush accepting his party's nomination. So, Wayne, I actually remember that speech, and some people kind of went, huh, what does that mean? And I just wonder what you think about how the president sometimes struggled to define who he was and how you would define his politics.
Sure. I think one of the other challenges he had along those lines was that a lot of Republicans didn't want to separate him from Reagan. This was a continuation of the Reagan Revolution. And so on some levels, he had that advantage of carrying the mantle forward. But the real challenge then is, how do you become your own person in that moment? He also juxtaposed George H.W. Bush to Ronald Reagan as an orator. Man, what a tough act to follow.
Right.
So he had these challenges. But, you know, if you begin with his biography, he had been at that point already a dedicated public servant since the age of 18. Remember, he left high school and joined the Navy. Became a fighter pilot, was shot down, earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. He's a war hero, then goes back to school. And all of the things that we've talked about, the ambassador to the UN, the envoy to China, director of Central Intelligence, another big role, a lifetime of public service. In later quotes, he says things like, what's wrong with being the quiet guy in the room? And, you know, you can sort of see over his time, I don't know if struggle is the right word, but an attempt to sort of define himself in his own way, on his own terms. I think as we look back now, probably now more than ever, we appreciate that quiet strength that he carried with him. And so, you know, to your question, I think it was an ongoing struggle. I didn't work for him, as these gentlemen all had, and I didn't know him the way they did. But I never got the sense that he was very comfortable as a political creature. I think he wanted to get through the politics to get to the policy. That's where he knew he would be very strong, and his record certainly proves that. So to some extent, if we expected him to be a Ronald Reagan, we were bound to be disappointed. That's not who he was. But he earned, I think, his own place in American history, in a very bright place, with the work that he did accomplish.
Well, all of you, and maybe to you first, Joel. So today, a lot of people remembering him as that moderate Republican, you know, willing to compromise and do what it takes to get to the policy, as Wayne said. But how would you describe his politics? From what I understand, you know, he sometimes took a harder line than that moderate middle.
Yeah, well, I do think at the time, I think he was trying to find a way. I mean, he defined Republicans much different than a Republican is defined today. I mean, he was environmental. I mean, it was the Clean Water Act. It was, you know, it was.
He signed the Clean Water Act.
Yes, yeah.
That's a big, big deal.
It's big. It's big. There were a number of things that would not be defined as purely Republican at the time.
So let me just toss a few of those in. The Americans with Disabilities Act, big one. Educational reform. I mean, these are not things you would typically associate. The Immigration Act of 1990. I mean, these are things that we don't today certainly associate with Republican Party.
And you got to remember, he was dealing with a very liberal Congress.
Congress,
and
exactly right.
And to be successful, I think he had to govern a little bit more towards the middle. And I don't think it was an uncomfortable space for him to be in. But then on foreign policy, you know, I think he was more of your traditional Republican, except he had a very strong pedigree of understanding the last really military president that served
the last World War II president.
Last
right?
one.
Right.
Yeah. So. Anyway, so I think that's all, you know, that's sort of who he is.
Dave Carney, I'd love to ask you that question, too, and then I want to talk a little bit more about some of these particulars that you gentlemen mentioned. But if someone said to you, Dave, how would you describe George Bush's politics, how would you answer?
Main Street conservative Republican. You know, he was a conservative. In some areas, he is more conservative than Ronald Reagan. In other areas, you know, he was willing to get things done, which he thought were needed, whether it was taking some, you know, concrete steps on AIDS prevention and research, or the things that the other folks have already talked about. But he was, his style was different than today, and it has been for a while. That, you know, he was willing to listen to both sides. I mean, and to disagree with the Democrats in Congress, Jim Wright and those guys, and George Mitchell, but also not to be disagreeable, that he could, you know, hold the line on his on trying to get done what he wanted to get done. But, you know, there was no hatred of the other side or putting motives and intentions on the other side that, you know, created what they, you know, somehow they're evil or partisan or trying to do something to undermine America. I mean, that was certainly not his never thought that way, and always.
He didn't demonize his opponents.
Correct.
Yeah. Wayne, did you want to jump in?
Just I guess, to add quickly to that point, if you think back, and this seems like ancient history now, to the end of the Soviet Union and, you know, the Berlin Wall coming down, any red-blooded American would have jumped at the opportunity to really crow about America's victory. And they could have framed it that way. But President Bush had the insight to know that if the American president seemed to be basking in a win, that the reformers—
Fist-pumping the fact
right,
that the
exactly,
Berlin Wall went down.
The reformers in Moscow would have been in serious trouble with the hardliners. And so he has the presence of mind, and I think this is probably in his nature, and these guys would know better than I would, to not sort of jump on the bandwagon there and to really sort of temper his conversations and his observations at that point to give the reformers a chance. The American president was restrained. Let that sink in for a minute.
Okay. Tom, I'll go to you real quick after a short break, okay? And we'll talk a lot more. I also want to touch more on foreign policy since everybody mentioned it, and that's a big, big deal. We'll start taking your calls and questions, too. Send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. exchange@nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. A lot more to talk about after a short break. Stay with us.
Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a trip to the white sand beaches of Captiva Island, Florida. You'll also be entered to win our grand prize, a trip for two to Barcelona, Spain, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. Enjoy 6 days perusing the Museo Picasso or taking in a flamenco show at Los Torantos, Barcelona. You'll be automatically entered to win both trips when you sustain the news you trust and the programs you love right now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire reflects on the presidential campaigns and the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush, who died over the weekend at age 94. Let's hear from you. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Joel Meola is with us in studio, chief of staff for former Republican Governor Judd Gregg, an early supporter of George Bush in his very first presidential campaign. Also with us, Tom Rath, a former attorney general, longtime Republican strategist in the state. Wayne Lesperance is here, political science professor at New England College. And on the phone, Dave Carney, he's CEO of Norway Hill Associates in Hancock, a national political consulting firm. He was White House political director for George H.W. Bush. One more time, that phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, before the break, we were talking about former President Bush's very strong foreign policy credentials. We talked a little bit over the weekend with former state lawmaker and former Congressman Charlie Bass, reflecting on Bush as well. And Bass said the former president's foreign policy credentials and experience really helped this country. Let's hear.
His ability to understand, to have a dynamic understanding of a very complex political situation and temper his role and the role of our country in that process to achieve the best possible outcome was something that really hasn't occurred since his day.
Again, that's former Congressman Charlie Bass. Tom Rath, what do you think?
Well, I think when you look at what President Bush brought to the Republican Party nationally in 1980, and as he became vice president, then when he became president, he was probably the best versed Republican in the ways of the world, so even more so than Governor Reagan was when he became president, that we've had since Eisenhower, in my judgment. And much of the worldview that he had was shaped by what Eisenhower did as president, particularly putting the world back together again after the Second World War. And President Bush, and Vice President Bush and President Bush understood the dynamic of a divided Europe and what it was going to take to bring it back together. And he understood the forces there. He also had, and I think this is remarkable about him, the ability to forge personal relationships with so many of these people. And, you know, we talk about the great moments, the great meetings. This man wrote thousands of notes to people. He picked up the phone in the most unusual times to wish somebody well, I'm thinking about you. And it was not uncommon for him to have that. And when you think of where we are today, which I don't think quite honestly is very good, the relationships we have with foreign leaders, President Bush was so different than that. And he really, in a lot of ways, put us on a track that lasted for probably 20 years.
Go ahead, Joel.
I think that's, you see that in New Hampshire, you know, where relationships mattered, mm-hmm. and how he treated people throughout, and people that were just meeting, right. or world leaders. It was the personal notes. It was the picking up the call when there wasn't a call needed,
and
having that relationship. It wasn't about getting even. It wasn't about, you know, every press release that that President Bush would put out didn't begin with I. You know, it was all about getting the job done, and he understood how to do it. And it was the pedigree, but it was also his ability to communicate.
Lots of people jumping into our conversation. Gentlemen, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Chris is calling in from Nashua. Chris, thanks for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Laura. Great show.
Good.
And I wanted to just follow up. I certainly respect that George Bush was a gentleman. I respect that he was competent. I think he was, you know, certainly qualified to be in the office. However, I don't have the same nostalgic view as some of your guests there. I mean, some of the things that really stick out to this day that bother me is how he completely flipped on his criticism of voodoo economics and his pro-choice position. He just threw those by the wayside to become Reagan's vice president. That was the first thing. And I think that was really important because it kind of set the stage, or continued to set the stage for what we see today. The second thing was that he lied about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra scandal. And he pardoned everybody involved. So we were never able to get an investigation of a serious scandal. I mean, we sold arms to terrorists and gave them to dictators or something like that. It was ridiculous. The third thing was he encouraged the Kurds and the Shiites to rise up against Saddam Hussein, and then he abandoned them, and thousands of them were slaughtered. So, you know, I think this is a very, very big part of his legacy that I don't think we should be glossing over. You know, just because he was a nice guy and, you know, relationships and he was a good man and, you know, his family's nice. So that's something that's always bothered me about his legacy. His son, Neil, with the Silverado savings and loan bailout, somehow mysteriously the money just reappeared and he was off the hook. You know, these are things that I think really should be dealt in a little more detail.
Well, Neil, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. And Wayne, there was a lot of criticism on the domestic side, and we'll talk foreign policy in a minute, of flip-flopping. A lot of Republicans were upset with the president on, you know, read my lips, no new taxes. So there was this big, he's a flip-flopper.
Sure. Certainly some would argue that that was what caused him so much trouble in 92 when he sought re-election, the pledge on no new taxes. It dug into his base. I don't think anybody here would describe George H.W. Bush, and they can speak for themselves, as the perfect man or the perfect president. And certainly there were any number of policy decisions and other decisions that folks would, with the benefit of history, look back on and say, boy, that was a mistake, or that was not the way we should have gone. And the caller has identified some of those. But I think in toto, when you look at the record of him as president, I think you find quite a bit to say is very positive domestically and in terms of foreign affairs, and we've talked about a few of them. I think there's more we could certainly say. I don't see the value at this point in going into all of those pieces. But sure, you know, I don't think anybody would say he was a perfect president. Far from it.
Well, and Dave Carney, to you, I'm sure this was talked about while you were at the White House. You know, our caller's right. President Bush did change his mind on some pretty big policies. So I just wonder what you think about our caller's comments, Chris and Nashua.
Yeah, well, some of the things I'm not familiar with. But, you know, I can speak from a third row seat of on the tax situation. You know, we had a Democratic controlled Congress, and the only way to get veto the budget twice, the Republicans barely were able to sustain the veto. And then the Republicans were sick of closing down the Washington Monument, and, you know, we're going, as Margaret Thatcher would say, wobbly on the president. And his only alternative was to negotiate an opportunity to get a reasonable budget, and he got $3 of spending cuts for every dollar of spend of taxes. And, you know, his point is that trying to do good, try to do what's the right thing for the country, which is try to get the budget under control. And in 2 years, pretty much we had a balanced budget due to the foundation that the president laid out at the Andrews negotiations, which were very controversial. And he, you know, went back on his political pledge on no new taxes in order to get the budget under control. Back then, trying to have a balanced budget meant something. I don't know if anybody in Washington today even knows what that means. You know, $21 trillion deficit. I mean, it's staggering what our grandchildren are going to be, beyond learning Mandarin, have to deal with in 50 years.
Learning
but
Mandarin, you're referring to Chinese investment in American debt and deficits.
And more than that, yeah. But his point and what he wanted to do was do what's best for the country and the future of the country, which was to get public spending under control. The $3 to $1 never made it beyond, you know, maybe the 15th paragraph in a Washington Post story. The whole, discussion was on going back on his pledge. But, you know, he felt it was always best to do the right thing, and regardless of politics. And it's just sort of, it's become this urban myth, that he just, you know, was that something he wanted to do. He didn't want to do it. He had to do it, or we would have had, you know, continuing resolutions or the democratically, passed budget, which would have exploded spending, which would be today, a small matter. But back there in 1990, it was a, 1990, 1991, and it did hurt him tremendously. Members of his cabinet, Jack Kemp at HUD and others, you know, publicly spoke out against it and tried to distance themselves for it. And it was a bad year and a half.
Go ahead, Joel.
Well,
yeah,
I just to Dave's point, it would have been politically the right move never to have done that. Never to gone back on, but was it the right thing to do? And I think
fiscally,
I think that was the beauty of George H.W. Bush, is that it wasn't all about just doing the political thing. It was doing the right thing and pulling together people. I mean, you look at the way Washington acts today. Is everyone is very defined in what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. And there's all sorts of pledges from every special interest group to lock them into these positions. And there's a reason why nothing is getting done, and the deficits continue to soar, and people are just don't feel that government is responsive. I think this move, and he knew the political consequences of that when he took it, but he did it because it was the right thing and was needed.
Well, our caller Chris also mentioned the military operation in Kuwait, where President Bush put together a global coalition or an international coalition to flush Iraq out of Kuwait, Operation Desert Storm. Now, Chris critiqued what happened afterwards. We'll talk about that, Chris, but let's hear a little bit from the president himself announcing the end of Operation Desert Storm. This is in February 1991.
Kuwait is liberated. Iraq's army is defeated. Our military objectives are met. Kuwait is once more in the hands of Kuwaitis in control of their own destiny. We share in their joy, a joy tempered only by our compassion for their ordeal. Tonight, the Kuwaiti flag once again flies above the capital of a free and sovereign nation.
Okay, so I'm old enough to remember that speech, Wayne Les Brons. So that was seen by the world, not just this country, as a huge victory. And even today, people praise President Bush for his restraint. But our caller, Chris, also mentions that some people say, hey, look, he did encourage Iraqis to rise up against Saddam. They did so, and Chris is right, many were slaughtered. So I just wonder if you can just put this in the full picture for us, please.
Sure. I mean, Chris is right. Those folks were encouraged to take up arms against Saddam Hussein. Actually, you know, the larger criticism that we've heard about President Bush on this was the decision not to keep going. Remember the 100-hour war.
Some people wanted him to continue
going.
Go to
Baghdad.
Which his son did.
That's right. Later, right. So, but the president's calculations on that were pretty astute. Again, he brought a world of experience with him. It was the old Colin Powell argument. If you break it, you own it. And to some extent, the feeling was that if Iraq were going to be reconstituted, it would need to be done in a way that was not going forward. Ultimately, that proved to not be the policy that endured. But remember, he's balancing more, greater geopolitical forces, right? You have Iran, who is an adversary of the United States on the border, and there had to be, historically, Iraq was the balancer to Iran. You had Turkey, who had very strong feelings about a Kurdish uprising, a NATO ally that had to be balanced. So you had the Saudis in the south who wanted less instability in the country because of the impact on the oil, which is all located right there in the northern end of the Persian Gulf. The president had a lot of geopolitical factors he had to weigh, and he had a lot of allies he had to bring along in these conversations. So it's not as simple, I think, as perhaps Chris mentioned, that he encouraged folks and then turned his back on them. There were very powerful forces at work that the president had to consider in all of his decision. And at the end of the day, it was a very tough choice, I think, he made. I think President Bush later on obviously made a different choice. But remember what happened in those intervening—
You mean the second president.
The second
Bush.
President, sorry.
Yeah, and that had its own—
That's right. But remember the intervening years when President Clinton was there, who was also criticized quite a bit for not doing more in support of the Kurds and the Shiite community, the Marsh Arabs, as they were called. So this was not something unique to President Bush. It was an ongoing challenge in a very difficult part of the world.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you joining our conversation. And David's calling in from Thornton. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. I'm a third-generation Japanese-American and was interned during World War II in the internment camps.
Wow.
And during President Bush's administration, a bill was signed for reparations and a letter of apology. And I received that letter along with the reparations. And when I speak to civic groups and school groups, I ask the audience what they value more, the letter or the monetary reparations. And more often than not, they indicate that the letter is much more valuable. And I think this illustrates, again, President Bush reaches out to the small people and makes a big change in some people's lives. I just wanted to relay that story to you.
Well, and David, I'm so glad you called. So just remind our listeners who may not be familiar. So during President Bush's time in office, what happened again? Just remind us.
Well, there was a bill that was introduced into Congress for a $20,000 reparation for about 100,000 Japanese Americans that were interned in 10 of the internment camps throughout the United States during
right.
World War II. And it took quite a few years for the Japanese American community to come together and make this request. And it was President George Bush that ultimately signed the bill that awarded the reparations and the recognition that the country had done something wrong. And in his letter, he indicated that this would never happen again.
It's really good to hear from you, David. Go ahead, Wayne.
Just from the letter, I mean, this is some of the language here. He writes, but we can take a clear stand for justice and recognize that serious injustices were done to Japanese Americans during World War II. And this is the letter that accompanied the compensation that was provided. Remember, too, there were a lot of folks who were opposed to this at the time. Politically, this is another risky move. And for some, the idea was you should not apologize. This was not a war that the United States began. And President Bush at the time very rightly said, this is not a war that Japanese Americans began
right.
either. And that was a very important piece, I think.
Thank you
great
for
call.
Reading that, Wayne. Yeah. And David, thank you so much. Tom?
I think a lot of people would argue, I think correctly, that one of the worst decisions ever by the United States Supreme Court was the decision allowing internment camps to go forward. It was the law of the land for a period of time. And I think it was an act of both political courage and also a sort of social correctness to stop that and to do it in not just in the corner in the dark where nobody saw it. He faced the issue head on, and I think it was an important step forward.
All right. Well, thank you again for that call, David. And a couple of emails here that I want to share with you. Here's one, a listener, David, and Susan also. David sent us an email about this. Susan on Facebook said, although I admire 41 for his diplomatic strengths and his integrity, particularly his post-presidency charity work, which you should talk about, gentlemen, because she's right. That's really interesting. Susan says it's also important not to create a myth. During his vice presidency and during the presidential term of office, he ignored the AIDS epidemic and demonized the LGBT victims of this disease. So that's Susan on Facebook. Also, we got another one. This Bridget sent us an email. She says, in looking at the legacy of George H.W. Bush, don't forget he turned a blind eye to the oppressive and criminal Pinochet regime and supported other dictators in South America. He nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court and used the infamous Willie Horton ad against Dukakis in 1988. Bridget says, thank you for considering these aspects of Bush's legacy. So after a short break, guys, we'll talk about some of the other issues that our listeners raise. And I'm going to have you guys reflect on one of the biggest commentaries that I heard over the weekend, which is they don't make them like they used to when it comes to politicians like George Bush. So we'll take those emails into account for sure. We'll take more of your emails and calls. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a huge Exchange fan favorite, our annual holiday book show. Be sure to join us live at 9, or if you can't join us at 9, later online at nhpr.org, where all the information from our show will be posted. That's our holiday book show tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're hearing New Hampshire memories of President George H.W. Bush, who, as I'm sure you heard, died over the weekend. The elder George Bush had many, many Granite State connections, and we're learning more. Of course, we've been loving to hearing from you. It's been great. We've heard stories, criticisms, comments. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Dave Carney, just before the break, I read a couple emails from listeners who said, let's not paint too rosy a picture of this administration. There was Noriega. There were other issues. It wasn't all perfection. How did Democrats at the time that you were in the White House, Dave, feel about President Bush?
As political adversaries, but I think, the particularly leadership had a very, comfortable personal relationship with the president, whether it was George Mitchell or Jim Ryder or the various leaders, Dan Raskinkowski, who was chairman of the Budget Ways and Means for 100 years. There was just it was a different tone. It was different being able to work together. But, I think things like the Ryan White Act in terms of the first piece of legislation to be signed by a president dealing with, the AIDS epidemic. I mean, I think there are things that he took with the Congress that actually is different than what the a memory of one of the emailer, Susan. I mean, clearly the president never, ever did anything publicly or privately that I'm aware of to disparage or to, use gay political, the gay issue, if you will, as an issue politically. It just wasn't his, cup of tea, if you will. And, the world's a tough place out there. And, I think, as we're talking about the Iraq War, I mean, he got, I think, 97 countries to join that coalition, including Japan for the first time since World War II actually participated in a military activity. It was hospital ships for in the first Iraq War. It was, they sent six vessels to the Gulf to be in support of the operation. I mean, these are some historic things. The entire Arab world, other than Iran, involved in some aspect of this war, and this is because he understood the geopolitical world very, very well. But more importantly, he had relationships with these people, whether it was his time in the United Nations ambassador or as vice president, to build up a personal relationship, knowing these leaders, taking their calls and they taking his calls, and him making the case that this was for the betterment of the world to put Saddam, get Saddam out of Kuwait, and it worked. But nothing is perfect, and he had never had a Republican Congress that allowed him to kind of do the things he would have preferred to do. He was always dealing with Democrats in the House that he had to sort of cajole and negotiate with on every single item. So
well, and I'm glad you mentioned that.
Certain things weren't done. It's many times it was done because the Congress didn't act on certain things.
And sorry to interrupt, Dave. I have to say, I mean, I remember the Bush presidency, but I had forgotten that he had to work with a Democratic Congress. So two of the critiques that came in also from our listeners, one I want to throw to you, Tom Rath. One listener said, look, he put Clarence Thomas on the bench. Now, that listener clearly doesn't think Clarence Thomas was a good choice. What about the Supreme Court nominations that President Bush made, Clarence Thomas and?
There's a fellow from New Hampshire, I think he put on the bench as well. And you got to remember the sequence. Souter went on before Thomas did. Souter replaced Brennan. And that Brennan was kind of the leader, in a lot of ways, the intellectual leader of a certain part of the court. And there were some who wanted a complete reversal of that. And he put Souter on in an interesting process. And I will plead guilty to being marginal in that process. But what happened there was a desire. Souter had been cleared in a process for the court some time before by Thornburg, who was the Attorney General. So that when this opening came up, the idea was he was going to make it fairly quickly. And again, he didn't have the Senate with him. Rudman was, of course, his sort of protector. And our thought, friends of David's, where if we could get David Souter one-on-one with George Bush, George Bush would choose David Souter because of the quality of these two individuals. He did. Souter was the last guy to get 90 votes, at 190 to 9. Then Ted Kennedy was one of the nine who said no, and later he said to Souter's biggest mistake I ever made. But when you talk about Thomas, which I think is a fair comment, remember that the critical vote, the most important decision since Roe, I think, was Casey. And Casey was a majority that was fashioned in large part by Souter.
And remind us what Casey was.
And Casey was the Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And it was that it basically said states had the right to put certain restrictions on it, but they could not basically withdraw the basic right for a woman to make these choices. And I think Casey is seen as the natural progeny of Roe, and it brings Roe into a relevance in which state by state there was an attempt to underride or undercut Roe by doing things a state legislature.
So that was written
I think
by
it was
Souter.
Most people give great relevance to the Casey decision, and that was largely brought on by a decision that was participated in by and signed by one of the Bush appointments. But look, no president who's worth their salt is going to have a perfectly clean or linear record.
Well, and everybody and defines clean perfectly, right? Some people might think, be glad
right,
that Clarence Thomas was
And what
on
you
the
want
court,
is balance.
Even though our listener wasn't.
Right, you want balance and you want fairness and you want consistency and you want, and in my judgment, today particularly, overriding, you want decency. And that George H.W. Bush had in abundance.
Although one of our listeners, Wayne Lesbruns, also brought up the Dukakis ad, the Willie Horton ad, and that was not in the tradition of decency. I mean, that ad was pretty, it was pretty harsh, although by today's standards, maybe it set the model for today. But just remind our listeners who might not remember that ad what it was and the role it played in that presidential campaign where George Bush won.
Right. So this was an ad that I disclosed earlier that I had as a professor, Governor Dukakis at Northeastern in my time there. And this is an ad he talked about every chance he got. And if you would talk to him informally about the election, it came back to two things. One was that damn tank ride he took.
I was going to say he got in the tank himself.
That's right. I can't blame George Bush for that.
And the other was the Willie Horton ad. And he's still smarting about it all these years later. In a nutshell, Willie Horton was somebody that was in the Massachusetts system. They had a system of furloughs. The ad went on to portray Willie Horton as getting out and committing some pretty gruesome acts. And all of it was used to depict Governor Dukakis as being soft on crime. It was, as I recall, a very grainy black and white ad. I mean, it appealed in a visceral way to people that consumed it. It was tough politics, and it was, I believe, at the time, it was the product of a fellow named Lee Atwater, who was associated with the president, who was a tough politico. I mean, he did not put on kid's gloves. There have been counters or others like him. James Carville, for example, is very much on the Democratic side from the Lee Atwater school in some ways. Karl Rove is another that worked with Lee Atwater. That, I guess in some sense, we'd be Pollyanna to think, wow, that was the first time politics got rough.
you got to go back.
I would give you a talk on the election of
1800. All the way back to the founding,
but
basically.
Anyway, this was one of those that Governor Dukakis certainly grabbed onto. And the other piece, the real criticism, was the racial undertones to it. That were pretty tough.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners. And again, thanks for those emails. Gave us lots to think about. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's clear Wayne was taught by Mike Dukakis. the Willie Horton ad was done by Floyd Brown, by a separate independent national conservative defense PAC. It was independent expenditure. It ran for about 500 gross rating points in a few states, which is a very, translate that into words. It was a, very small buy that got blown up and designed to blown up, to become very controversial.
It went viral in our terminology today.
The Bush
today.
Campaign did not do this ad. It did not coordinate with this ad. Floyd Brown, did the ad. He was very proud to take credit for doing the ad. It really put, for a few weeks that particular independent expenditure pack that, on the radar as being a big player. I think the president takes a lot of heat for the Willie Horton ad, which, you know, most people, particularly back then, would say was, you know, it wasn't very tasteful. It was really over the edge. But that wasn't the campaign. And some, you know, this is, you know, federal election law really precludes campaigns from having a say in things, what goes on, because these PACs are independent.
Well, we still talk about this today, don't we, Dave? And then some people say, okay, but can you call them and tell them to take it down? I mean...
Well, they only ran for a very short period of time because they didn't have any money. But it generated so much news on the network news and elsewhere that it probably got, you know, two or three times the exposure in terms of the earned media, if you will, off the ad than the actual paid ad got. It was a very clever ploy by the group. I know Floyd. It's, you know, clearly, you know, he's something he still relishes to talk about today. But you know, it was it hit a very soft nerve with the Dukakis campaign for sure. But
smarting today, as
yes,
Wayne tells
yes.
us. Well,
but
again,
it wasn't the campaign. It wasn't Lee. Lee has plenty of issues that, in terms of hardcore campaigning, but this particular one was not the campaign or the brainchild of Lee.
All right. Well, good to have that clarification. Sure. And back to our listeners. Again, thanks for those comments. Mike's calling in from Bedford. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead, Mike.
Before we leave, I'd like a comment on the effect of firing John Sununu, his chief of staff, Dave's there, so John was the one who brought Dave Carney into the spotlight. If you haven't noticed said a lot of things about the Clean Air Act and the other environmental things that John Sununu, the chief of staff, was really responsible for. But mostly, what does probably Dave Carney think about firing?
Well, I'm so glad you called, Mike, because that's a strong New Hampshire connection. And we did mention the Clean Air Act very briefly, but you're right, we haven't talked about it a lot. Also, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that was another huge, huge law that the president signed. But what about that, Dave? Again, some of our younger listeners might not remember. Again, John Sununu, chief of staff, former governor of New Hampshire, serves for a while, but kind of doesn't fit in with that D.C. culture, Dave, and ends up getting fired.
Yeah, I was there at the White House, you know, and there and afterwards. And, at the point, he'd been there for 3 years. At the point, and chiefs of staff generally don't last that long. And as we're going to the reelect that time, Buchanan, I think, announced on December 10th, if I'm right, or maybe late November. But I think it was December 10th he actually announced he was running. And this was December 6th or 4th when the governor left. So, you know, at that time, it didn't appear that we were going to have a primary, issue. The president in November, early November of 91, was at something like an 89 or 91% approval rating, living off of this very successful effort in Kuwait. And so, I think the president was looking at, that at some point your effectiveness is diminished. And I don't think it was a bad thing that they made a change. I think the bad thing was the change they made. Instead of going to Jim Baker, which had been, I think, the president's preference, and I think has been written about, to come out of the Secretary of State and come back and be the campaign chief of staff, they went with Sam Skinner, who had been an electric utility executive in Illinois, had been very active in the campaign, and was the Secretary of Transportation. And he did not have the skills or the breadth of experience to be able to be effective. And then he ended up being there a few months before Jim Baker came in, I think, in June of 92. And at that point, the Titanic had, the iceberg well in sight, and it was very difficult for Secretary Baker to make much of a change.
Wow.
Had Secretary Baker come in place of Sununu in December of 91, I don't think we would have. I think the president would have won re-election. There's a couple of fundamental things, but that was one of them that I think would have changed the dynamics and the direction of the campaign. But at every time, no one is just dispensable, and as the governor I think wrote in his book, you're there to serve the president, and I think at the time came when the governor felt he was no longer effective, and so he stepped down. And I think that was a right thing. Instead of fighting for it or dragging it out, he very astutely stepped aside, and you know, unfortunately, you know, Secretary Baker was, you know, intimately involved in the Mideast peace process, and felt that, you know, like every other Secretary of State since, you know, Eisenhower.
Dave, I got to jump in on you. I do apologize, but we're getting close to the end, and I did want to share something that Lynn on Facebook wrote. Lynn remembers George H.W. Bush as, quote, strong, committed to public service, respectful, worked with both parties without disparaging and name-calling. And, Joel, that seems to be a lot of what we've been hearing this weekend, that, sure, I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, fair criticism of some of the policy choices that the former president made, but fundamentally a decent human being.
Very decent human being. And that, I don't know, I think people will say, well, that's a sign of, you know, weakness. Or, he was a leader, and he was well-groomed for the office, had everything you would want in a president, I thought, in the way he can communicate with people and bring in the best and brightest. And I think that's one thing that's always overlooked in talking about the Governor Sununu. But you look at the Colin Powells and the people that stayed with him through a lifetime. And they weren't there for a cup of coffee and in and out of an administration. They became not only leaders for the country for decades, but remained close personal friends. And that's sort of the legacy that George W. Bush.
Tom.
Well, he wrote a book of his letters called All My Best, and I think that really typifies who he is. I said he's great because he was good. And when we look today at what we would like in a president beyond positions on issues, we want a good person who typifies the best qualities one-on-one of America. And I think George H.W. Bush absolutely meets that test.
Well, all of you, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it was probably an emotional weekend for all of you. So I really, really appreciate you coming in. There's a lot more we could have talked about. Thank you all so much for being here.
Great. Thank you, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.